Chapter 13. 19:30 hours, July 4th, 2553, military calendar. Crime scene, India, 504 meters below ground, Montero Cavern System. Campos Wilderness District, Planet Gao, Cordoba System. Fred could not see much from the rear of the line, just a halo of light reflecting off the stone around Veda Lopez's backside as she crawled up the cramped passage ahead of him. Strapped across her shoulders were the telescoping support rails of the emergency evacuation litter in which Olivia rode. The forward end of the litter was strapped to Ash's back, just above his hips, and occasionally Fred caught a glimpse of Ash's helmet as it scraped the passage ceiling. But most of the time, all he saw in front of him was Lopez's muddy butt. He tried to be a gentleman about it, but there weren't a lot of other places he could look. The Hurragach was floating up the passage somewhere ahead of Ash, or at least Fred hoped it was. The thing had long ago severed its leash and started to drift around on its own, but it seemed to be sticking close and keeping a watchful eye on Olivia. Fred hoped that would continue, because he did not look forward to explaining to Margaret Perengoski how he had let a new kind of Hurragach wander off. Mark was supposed to be on point, but Ash had lost sight of him, and that made Fred nervous. Mark had taken his last smoother 16 hours earlier, and he had been growing agitated and contentious for the last hour. The type of smoother the Gammas of Blue Team were using on this operation were the most common and versatile of several different options. They lasted about 12 hours, then began a steady decrease in effectiveness. In theory, it would be another half day or so before the young Spartan began to suffer fits of temper and physical outbursts. But stress and fatigue could accelerate the unraveling process. And, after an exhausting 12-hour climb up from the Forerunner base, Fred's squad had just spent another 4 hours crawling through the maze of waist-high passages. With any luck, they would reach Crime Scene India soon. There, Fred expected a rendezvous with the small support squad that should have remained behind when Kelly, Linda, and the rest of the protection team left to escort the GMOP crime techs back up to Wendosa. Fred would have liked to pause there to grab a few hours of rest, but with all three Gammas bereft of smoothers, it was out of the question. The squad would down a few rations, then start the 12-hour climb out. If Lopez held up as well as she had so far, they would be able to cut the trip down to 8. If they could do that, Mark would probably still be rational when they reached the surface. The halo of reflected light surrounding Lopez's butt suddenly dimmed, and the line came to a halt as Ash stopped moving. Fred pressed his helmet to the cavern wall and peered forward. The passage seemed to end about 5 meters ahead, where Ash's lamp beam swelled into a diffuse cone and vanished into the darkness of a huge chamber. "I think we're there," Ash said, speaking over TeamCom. "I can see the breakdown pile where India victim was found." "What about Mark?" Fred would have preferred to be at the front of the line looking for himself. But with his powerful Mjolnir armor, he had been the logical choice to drag Halal and Hayes along, and it would have been poor tactics to obstruct the passage by putting a pair of corpses in the middle of the line. "Any sign of him?" Ash remained silent for a moment, then said, "Nothing on the motion tracker." His lamp beam turned and dropped toward the cave floor. "But I have fresh tracks heading off at 10 o'clock. They look like Mark's, and he was moving fast." Fred cursed under his breath. It seemed impossible that Mark had already unraveled into a full paranoid state. But alien environments multiplied other stress factors, and by any definition that counted, the Montero cave system was an alien environment. "What about a support squad?" Fred asked. "Not that I can see." "No surprise there," Lopez said, also speaking over TeamCom. "We're how long overdue? More than a day?" "Doesn't matter. The support squad should be here," Fred said. When he and his squad reached 10 hours overdue, escort protocol would have dictated that Kelly and the other Spartans evacuate their charges under heavy protection. But it also mandated that they leave behind a supply cache and a 3-person support team, then return to initiate a search as soon as possible. And Kelly should be back with the rest of Blue Team and a search party by now.
"Right," Lopez scoffed.
because it's so easy to keep a schedule down here. Fred started to reply that Spartans were expected to meet their schedules, then recalled that on the way out of the cave, Kelly and her squad would only be able to move as fast as the GMOP techs they were escorting. Given the long climb to the surface and the likely exhaustion of the civilians, it was entirely possible they hadn't even made it back to Wendosa yet, much less Battalion HQ. Fair enough, Fred said, but that still doesn't explain a missing support squad. Ash, move us out to a secure position where we can leave Inspector Lopez and Olivia. And you two are going where? Lopez demanded. To reconnoiter. Isn't that what Mark is supposed to be doing? Mark's not in contact right now, Fred said. That's why Ash and I need to reconnoiter. Not in contact, Lopez echoed. Have you lost control of him already? Before Fred could reply, Ash started to crawl forward, drawing the litter along and forcing Lopez to follow. Fred signaled his gratitude by sending Ash a green status flash. The inspector had been asking a lot of unpleasant questions about Mark, Smoothers, and Gamma Company brain mutations, and Fred didn't have time right now to explain why he didn't think Mark could be the killer. Especially since Lopez was unlikely to accept, "because I know him," for an answer. In the vast chamber that contained Crime Scene India, a secure position turned out to be a muddy niche about a meter high and 2 meters wide, tucked in behind a jagged fence of stalagmites. The niche was recessed into the cave wall, so there was no need to worry about an enemy sneaking up from behind. But the low ceiling and lack of an easy escape made Veda feel trapped and jumpy, and she found herself staring out into the unrelieved darkness with the same sense of dread she had once experienced in the pitch blackness of a hidden cellar, listening for the whisper of boot soles on stone, the same way she had once listened for the clack of a rising latch. Here she heard only water, the solitary plink of a stalactite releasing a droplet into a nearby pool, the trickle of a rivulet descending a stony slope, the distant hiss of a cascade plummeting into a bottomless pit. It was maddening, a slow torture that made Veda's chest tighten in fear. Breathe. The whispered word came from the darkness next to Veda, where Olivia lay on her belly, holding the M7 SMG and peering out into the cavern's vast blackness. The young Spartan was still unable to walk comfortably, but under the Huragok's care, her broken femurs had mended enough to bear her weight, and if she was in pain, her whisper did not betray it. In through your nose, hold, out through your nose, Olivia continued softly, slow and natural. It'll calm you. Who says I need calming? Your body does, Olivia said. You keep forgetting to breathe, then you draw air in so hard that I can hear you. And there's a bitter tang to your odor. Yeah, well, neither of us smells so great, Veda said. We haven't showered in days. Olivia's voice sharpened to a hiss. This is no joke, Inspector. You need to steady yourself. If something happens, you won't be able to hit a thing. Veda started to ask why Olivia expected trouble, then realized how foolish that would have sounded. In the Spartans' world, the key to survival was readiness and teamwork. And at the moment, Veda was hardly prepared for the unexpected, and she was certainly not someone who could be counted on during a fight. Sorry. Veda began to pay more attention to her breathing. I have a problem with tight spaces. Ah. Olivia fell silent. For a moment it seemed like she was probably thinking something unkind. But then she said, You'll be fine. We all have things like that. Veda smiled into the darkness. Sure you do. No, really, Olivia said, still keeping her voice to a whisper. Mine is fire. White fire, to be exact. White fire? From a plasma strike, Olivia explained. The shrinks say it's because I saw my family taken out by one, but I don't remember it that way. Veda was stunned, as much by Olivia's openness as by the tragedy she was describing. How do you remember it? Olivia hesitated, then her voice grew thready and soft.
I just looked up, and they weren't there anymore. Nothing was.
Veda wanted to reach over and comfort the girl, but she suspected that a hug, or even a reassuring pat, probably wasn't something a Spartan would welcome or understand. Instead, Veda said,
That had to be hard.
Probably.
An edge came to Olivia's whisper.
But it gave me purpose. I can see that.
Actually, it seemed to Veda the UNSC had used the tragedy to turn Olivia into one of its killing machines. But she knew better than to say so, especially if she wanted to keep the girl talking.
Is that true for most Spartan Threes?
They volunteered because they wanted vengeance for what the Covenant had done to their families?
Maybe at first, Olivia admitted. But by the time you're trained, you just want to keep it from happening to someone else.
And you think that feeling is pretty universal?
Veda asked. For Ash and Mark, too? Olivia paused before answering.
Why do you keep asking about Mark?
I asked about Ash, too.
But you want to know about Mark, Olivia said. You think he's your man.
He's certainly on the list of suspects, Veda said. But so are the rest of the Spartans, along with hundreds of anti-Earth radicals who might be trying to stir up sentiment against the occupation.
Right. But Mark is at the top of your list.
That's not the way I work, Veda replied. I don't rank suspects as more or less likely. I just start eliminating possibilities until there's only one left. That's why I'm asking you about Mark. I'm trying to rule him out.
It was an old lie, and one that Olivia seemed to see through immediately.
So you've already eliminated me and Ash?
Not yet, Veda admitted. I'm working on Mark right now.
Then you're wasting your time. Mark is no serial killer.
Given the circumstance, it seems hard to be sure of that, Veda said. How often does he disappear like this?
This is different. He's off his smoothers.
And that can't happen another time?
Why would it?
Spiking out is no fun. Nobody would do it on purpose. You wouldn't do it on purpose, Veda corrected. But nobody can know everything that goes on in another person's head.
Besides, I didn't ask you how often Mark went off his smoothers. I asked you how often Mark has disappeared without an explanation.
Olivia fell silent, and Veda began to hope her pointed retort had raised some issues in the girl's mind, that Olivia was thinking back on Mark's behavior and asking herself some hard and unpleasant questions. After a moment, Veda began to press again.
Look, I'm not saying Mark is the one we're looking for. I'm just trying to establish whether he could be. If you tell me he's never... We need to be quiet.
Olivia's tone was brusque, and it seemed clear that she now regretted her earlier openness.
We wouldn't want to give away our position.
Sure, Veda said. Maybe you can use the time to think of something that will help me eliminate Mark as a suspect.
Olivia's only reply was an icy silence. Settling in to wait, Veda felt a pang of guilt for exploiting their conversation as she had. But that was her job. Nobody ever wanted to believe that a friend or loved one could be a murderer. When they learned the truth, their first reaction was usually to be angry with the investigator who had opened their eyes. The darkness began to close around Veda again, so she took Olivia's advice and began to concentrate on her breathing.
In through the nose. Hold. Out through the nose.
She didn't find it very calming, but at least it kept her mind from wandering back to the cellar. The casualty lay next to the breakdown pile where India victim had been discovered a couple of days before, a mound of sturdy Jiral Hanai flesh lying in a pool of his own blood. He was on his back, his chest armor rising and falling as he stared into the dark dome above his head. The spilled blood still showed orange in Fred's thermal imaging system, so the warrior could not have been there long, 10 minutes at most. This was the 7th casualty Fred had discovered in the vast chamber.
but the only living one. The three Marines, the support squad he had expected to find waiting for them, lay where they had fallen, their plasma-scorched bodies cold but not yet decaying. The Kig-Yar had been just as cold, its slender avian body riddled with UNSC bullets. But the other two casualties, another Jerohanai and a human in black battle fatigues, had still been warm, the blood just starting to crust along the edges of the knife wounds that had killed them. Fred knelt down beside the brute, and being careful to keep the beam shielded as much as possible, activated his wrist lamp. In its dim light, the Jirohanai's armor appeared to be blue with gold trim, a pattern that his HUD identified as common to the Keepers of the One Freedom. The mission briefing had mentioned the Keepers, describing them as a sect of ex-Covenant religious zealots based in nearby Venezia. How they had come to be involved in the situation on Gao, Fred had no idea. But given the Covenant's obsession with all things Forerunner, it seemed likely that they were after the same thing he was. The Ancilla. A wet gurgle erupted from the Jirohanai's throat wound, and his dark eyes swung toward the lamp beam. Fred glanced at the dying warrior's arms just to make certain they remained paralyzed, but the deep slash across the back of the brute's neck suggested he was in no condition to fight. In fact, he appeared unable to move his head, or even cry out to the rest of his band. Fred could almost picture the strike that had crippled him. Taking the Jirohanai from behind, Mark had leaped out of hiding and driven his combat knife into the target's neck, then wrenched the blade sideways to cut the spine. A half-second later, he had carefully lowered the dying warrior to the ground and stalked off in search of his next victim. Even for a Spartan, the attack had been a masterwork, and it made Fred wonder just how deeply Mark G313 had devoted himself to the fine art of killing. Fred deactivated his wrist lamp, and his imaging systems reverted to the thermal band. Ash was standing guard on the opposite side of the fallen Jirohanai, his helmet slowly pivoting from side to side as he searched for danger. When he saw that Fred had finished inspecting the dying warrior, he cocked his helmet to one side, then pointed his thumb and pinky back toward the niche where they had left Veda Lopez and Olivia. "What now?" he was asking. "Back to the others?" Fred signaled, "Wait." He didn't know quite what to make of the situation in the chamber. Clearly there had been a battle here, and just as clearly, the Keepers had won. But that didn't explain much. For starters, the human in black fatigues hadn't been wearing any armor, so it was impossible to say whether he had been a Keeper zealot or a Gao radical. And it made a difference. If the Keepers had local guides helping them, the terrain advantage on the way out would belong to the enemy. Just as worrisome was the situation in Wendosa. On the one hand, Fred could not imagine a small, poorly trained force of religious zealots fighting past Charlie Company, much less Kelly and three more Spartans. So it seemed possible that a handful of Keepers had simply slipped into the caverns via an unguarded entrance. But if that were true, what had they expected to accomplish with such a small team? Were they just scouting ahead of a larger force? The answers were impossible to guess. There were just too many unknowns and too many explanations, both innocuous and catastrophic. Not that any of it made the slightest difference. Fred's first priority was clear: return to the surface and report the location of the Forerunner hangar to Commander Nelson. So was his second priority: confirm that the Keepers of the One Freedom were on Gao for the same reason he was, to recover the Ancilla and spoil their day. Whatever happened, that much was clear. Blue Team could not allow the Keepers to reach the core of the Forerunner base ahead of the 717th's scientists. Ash shouldered his battle rifle and spun a quarter circle, then quickly relaxed. Fred checked his motion tracker and spotted an unidentified contact drifting toward them. When he turned, a familiar tentacled blob lit up his infrared imaging system. The sight made him smile. After what the Huragak had done for Ash and Olivia, Fred was actually growing fond of it. The Huragak floated straight over to the dying Jirohanai, then activated its illumination tentacle and dangled its tentacles above his head and shoulders. The warrior's eyes grew wide, though whether it was with terror or wonder Fred could not tell, and his gaze remained transfixed as the Hurragach descended toward him. Fred put out a hand and gently pushed the creature away. The Hurragach retreated a couple of meters and hovered just beyond arm's reach. Its headstock was turned to one side, the three eyes on that side watching Fred. It appeared to be patiently awaiting its turn. Fred sighed. The Jirohanai was no threat in his current condition. But if the Hurragach put him back together, the situation would definitely change. Fred toggled Ash's status light, then tipped a thumb toward the Hurragach. Ash acknowledged with a downward finger flick, then stepped over and began to herd the Hurragach away. Once they were out of sight, Fred drew his combat knife and pressed the tip to the Jirohanai's brow. He couldn't risk the Hurragach sneaking back to heal the huge warrior, and hauling him along as a prisoner was out of the question. The Jirohanai stared into Fred's faceplate for a moment. Then the anguish seemed to drain from his expression, and he closed his eyes. Fred leaned forward, putting his weight into it, and drove the blade down through the warrior's skull. Better the Jirohanai than one of Fred's Spartans. Or Veda Lopez. Please remain silent, Special Inspector Lopez. The words were soft and wispy, a barely discernible hiss coming from the comm unit inside Veda's helmet. You must avoid any reaction to what I am about to tell you. This time, there was just a little more volume, enough to identify the voice as that of the battalion AI, Wendell. This is a sequestered channel, but you mustn't draw their suspicion by reacting. To do so would endanger your own life. I hope you understand. Veda nodded into the darkness. Whether Wendell could detect the motion, she had no idea. But she knew that Olivia couldn't. Without her SPI helmet, the young Spartan was as blind in this darkness as Veda was. You have placed yourself in grave danger, Inspector Lopez, Wendell said. Spartan 104 will never let you arrest one of his subordinates. He'll kill you first. Spartan 104, of course, was Fred, and Veda didn't particularly care about arresting anyone, as long as the perpetrator met justice. But was Wendell really suggesting that Mark was the prime suspect? Or was the AI just trying to scare her off, convince her to stop prying into Spartan secrets? Given that Wendell had been created to serve a battalion that was almost certainly on an Oni operation, it seemed all too likely that it was the latter. But that didn't mean Veda could just ignore the AI. If Wendell was trying to stymie her, it was probably because she was closing in on the truth, and that meant she needed to question him. Veda reached over and touched Olivia's arm. At least, she thought it was an arm. It was round and muscular and too large to grasp in one hand, so it might have been a neck or a thigh. Yes, ma'am, Olivia whispered. I can't stand this hole anymore, Veda said. I need to get out. Now? Only for a minute, Veda said, doing her best to sound desperate. I just need to stand up and get away from all this stone pressing in on us. You should wait, Olivia said. The lieutenant said not to move. I don't have a choice, Veda hissed. She reached out and found the stalagmite fence that separated them from the main chamber, then located a gap and began to crawl through. I'll be back in a few minutes. Stay close, Olivia ordered. Stay where I can cover you. Sure thing. Veda stumbled through the dark for a few steps, then finally yielded to her fear of tripping or stepping into a pit and activated her hand lamp. Not wanting to give away Olivia's position if any sentinels happened to be lurking nearby, she avoided looking back and began to pick her way forward. That is not avoiding a reaction, Inspector, Wendell complained. Quite the opposite. Are you trying to get yourself killed? I'm trying to find a killer. Veda covered her voice by deliberately shuffling her feet and sending a few stones clattering.
Are you confirming that Mark G313 is my prime suspect?
I have no direct knowledge of the killings, Wendell replied. But I can tell you that Frederick 104 has been covering for him. I've discovered some surveillance feeds and duty rosters that conflict with the alibis you've been given by the lieutenant and the Spartans under his command. Most of them regard Mark G313.
And you're certain there's a mismatch?
The pattern is quite clear, Wendell assured her. Even Spartans can't be in two places at once. I'll be happy to provide you with a log of the discrepancies when we return to headquarters.
Thanks, Veda said.
She knew better than to take anything Wendell said at face value. He was, after all, Oni property. But if he was trying to misdirect the investigation, that would be a clue in itself.
I'm sure that will prove useful.
I'm always happy to be of assistance, Inspector, Wendell said. And now, perhaps you should return to your hiding place. Olivia is certain to be growing suspicious, and you're putting both of you at risk by wandering.
Veda did not turn around.
This log, she said, you put it together while you were down here?
There was a short pause, no doubt while Wendell analyzed the reason for her question, and Veda knew whatever the AI's reasons for making the report, it had nothing to do with serving justice. After a moment, Wendell said,
I've had the data all along, I'm afraid, but I didn't see any reason to analyze it until you began to grow suspicious of Mark G313.
I see. Veda stopped at the edge of a shallow pool and shined her hand lamp into the rippling water. On the bottom glistened hundreds of calcite spheres, all more or less round and the color of alabaster. She was tempted to grab a handful to take back to the surface, but the Montero Park Authority had long ago outlawed the unlicensed collection of cave artifacts, so she contented herself with looking instead. Continuing to study the cave pearls, Veda asked, And why are you telling me this, Wendell?
Isn't it obvious? Wendell replied.
You're searching for the killer, and there is a very high probability that Mark G313 is the killer.
Veda shook her head. Not what I'm asking, she said. That's what I get, if your theory turns out to be right.
She stepped away from the pool, then heard a stone clatter in the darkness to her right. She turned her lamp toward the sound and saw nothing but a distant shelf of greenish flowstone. Determined to continue the interrogation while Wendell was willing to talk, she told herself the noise was probably just Olivia limping along, trying to keep an eye on her. She began to walk away from the clatter.
I want to know how you benefit by pointing me at a member of Blue Team, Veda said, continuing to whisper into her helmet mic. Protecting Gao civilians isn't exactly a mission priority for the UNSC.
Again, there was a perceptible hesitation as Wendell formulated a reply.
It is not in anyone's interest to have a murderer causing trouble right now, he finally replied. And since Frederick 104 is clearly unwilling to do what is necessary, you are the best option for resolving the situation.
The explanation was credible, but Veda wasn't sure it had the ring of truth. With an AI, honesty was hard to judge because there was no physical cues to observe. She paused, trying to find another angle to work, and she heard a slurping scrape somewhere behind her. The sound of a boot sole sliding down wet stone. It ended in a thud too loud to have been made by a Spartan, and it was followed by a throaty grunt. Veda reached for her sidearm and spun around, bringing her lamp up just in time to glimpse an ape-like figure in armor springing at her. She snapped her SAS-10 from its holster, but her attacker was already in midair, swinging a blocky pistol with a double-blade bayonet toward her head, and it seemed clear that even if she managed to kill it, it was going to return the favor. Veda raised the barrel of her SAS-10 and found herself flying sideways as a second armored body slammed into her. A male voice yelled, Down! And then she was buried beneath a lightly armored human, one of the Spartan threes. Her attacker crashed down somewhere beyond her feet, and Veda heard stones clattering as he attempted to try again.
Off! Veda yelled.
The Spartan was already leaping to his feet. Veda sat up and fired into the darkness. The roar of the SAS-10 was deafening, but her target was so close she could see him in the light of the pistol's muzzle flashes. A living mountain, first slowing, then jerking, staggering, and finally tumbling over backward as Veda hammered his chest with armor-piercing rounds. She finally stopped firing when she realized her target was no longer being illuminated by muzzle flashes. She ejected the SAS-10's half-empty ammo clip and loaded a full one, then retrieved her hand lamp and began to sweep the beam through the darkness. She saw only muddy ground and damp stone and the murkiness of a vast chamber. For a moment she thought that her unexpected savior had already vanished. Then she heard the wet thwack of a blade plunging into flesh. She swung the lamp toward the sound and found Mark kneeling over the corpse of her attacker, which she now recognized as a massive Jirohanai warrior. Mark was spattered helmet to boot in blood, and his combat knife was buried to the hilt in the Jirohanai's neck. There was a wild tension in his posture that suggested the Spartan might spring up and race away any instant. Instead, he withdrew his knife from the Jirohanai's throat and pointed the still dripping blade toward Veda's weapon. "You can put that away now," he said. "This guy was the last of them." Veda lowered the pistol, but she didn't return it to its holster. "You're sure?" "Yeah, Mom, I'm sure." "You said them?" Veda asked. "So there was more than one brute down here?" "Afraid so," Mark replied. "But like I said, they're all dead now." It did not escape Veda's notice that Mark had avoided telling her exactly how many Jirohanai he had killed. "What are they doing on Gao?" "Hard to say," Mark said. "I didn't get a chance to ask them." He wiped his knife clean on the Jirohanai's furry beard and returned the weapon to its sheath, then stepped over to Veda and offered a hand to pull her up. "And thanks for being so quick with that popgun of yours," he said. "You might have saved my life." Veda allowed him to pull her up. "Just returning the favor," she said. "You saved mine first."
"Yeah, I did."
Mark swiped two fingers across his faceplate, a gesture Veda had learned to recognize as a Spartan smile, then added, "So that makes us even now."